We can split the gold! You'll be rich!
In the antechamber, Will watches as Mr. Dorian swings the door shut, but with a bang, it won't close. Mr. Dorian pulls harder. Something is jamming the door. The bolt, Will says, now understanding the sound he heard earlier. It's shot back out! Mr. Dorian looks. Sure enough, a large metal bolt now protrudes. Once we were through the time zone, he murmurs. He must have tried to lock itself again.
What a shame!
Crows Brogan from the other side of the door.
Can't lock us in now, can you?
For the first time since Will met Mr. Dorian, he looks flustered.
Quickly, the ringmaster says. We need to get back.
Snow-laden trees flash past the open doorway. Marin climbs up the rope to the top of the funeral car. Will's next. Going down was one thing, but lifting himself hand over hand is altogether more difficult. She helps pull him over the top. Will looks about, astounded. From the east, the first light gilds the wrinkled slopes of the mountains that rise up all around the boundless. The sky throws an icy cloak around Will, and he shivers. Below him, Mr. Dorian starts to pull himself onto the roof and falters, his face pinched. Will and Marin kneel, grab hold of an arm each, and haul him over the edge. He nods gratefully, pulling the rope up after him. Will is shocked by how ill Mr. Dorian looks in the sun's glare.
Are you all right?
Marin asks.
Just winded, he says, standing.
It's done, says Will softly. It's over.
Not quite yet, says Mr. Dorian.
Will turns, silhouetted by the rising sun. Six brakemen loom large as they make their way across the roof of the Boundless toward them. Chapter 14. Atop the Boundless.
Get up!
Brogan roars. He kicks out at Mackie with his boot, catching him under the chin. Mackie splutters and then rolls over and retches on Brogan's boot.
What?
He moans.
You got jolted! Move back before it does it again! And pull Chisholm with you!
Chisholm's weaselly face begins to twitch, and he opens his eyes and sits groggily.
Jesus,
says Mackie, looking at the towering corpse of Cornelius Van Horn, its chest raggedly rising and falling.
Puppet is all, says Brogan, but it's got a grip on me. You'll need to bust its arm.
I don't like puppets, says Mackie.
You want to spend the rest of your life in prison? Get over here!
Wincing with revulsion, Mackie steps closer to the corpse. He grabs the skeletal wrist and tries to snap it.
Strong,
he mutters, pounding his fist against the forearm. The corpse puppet shoots out its other hand and latches on to Mackie's bicep.
It's got me,
he wails.
It's got me bad!
Idiot,
growls Brogan.
Chisholm, haul your lazy carcass over here and free us up!
Chisholm draws closer, eyes buggy with fear.
You sure this ain't the man himself?
He's underneath somewhere. This here's mechanical, says Brogan. Peel its sleeve back.
Chisholm gingerly undoes the cufflink on the corpse's sleeve and rolls it back. The color of the flesh is surprisingly lifelike, not hard like a mannequin's.
Look there, says Brogan. There's a little hatch or something.
Chisholm digs in with his penknife and pries open a panel. A series of taut wires runs like veins and sinew through the arm.
Cut it! That'll do the trick, says Brogan. You got wire cutters?
Here,
says Mackie, pulling a pair from his back pocket and handing them to Chisholm, who drops them to the floor.
Still a bit shaky, Chisholm says.
Hand 'em over, barks Brogan.
Brogan gets the teeth around the main wire and squeezes hard. Finally, there's a sharp crack, and the corpse's fingers go limp. Brogan pulls his arm clear. After freeing Mackie, Brogan looks furiously across the chamber at the crates of gold, unreachable. One step deeper into the room, and the floor would deliver another lightning bolt of electricity.
We'll come back for the gold, he says. Right now, let's make sure the other lads have taken care of Dorian.
The six brakemen pause, one car away from Will, and the others blocking their way to first class.
Where's Brogan?
the tallest of them shouts. Will realizes this isn't what they're expecting. Probably they thought they'd arrive to find the gold ready for the taking.
"He's locked up in the funeral car with Mackie and Chisholm," Mr. Dorian shouts back. "It's over, gentlemen. You've failed. And if you value your freedom, you'll have the sense to turn back and resume your posts. We've not had a good look at your faces yet."
Will waits tensely. Maybe they'll think Mr. Dorian has a pistol. In their fists, Will sees a flash of a knife, a long wrench, the glint of brass knuckles. They don't seem keen to back down.
"We can go forward to the locomotive," Will whispers to Mr. Dorian. "There's the firemen, engineers, my father."
Mr. Dorian says nothing, his pale face still fixed on the brakeman. He looks like a strange raven more than ever, his black jacket blowing in the wind like spread wings.
"What do we do?"
Marin asks her ringmaster. He looks about, bewildered, and mutters to himself,
"They should be here."
"Who?"
Will asks.
"Get rid of them!"
A voice behind Will shouts, and he turns to see Brogan clambering like a monkey up the side of the funeral car, followed by Mackie and then Chisholm. Will swallows. They're surrounded, front and back. With a shout, the six brakemen rush forward.
"We'll get past them," Will says to Marin. "They can come at us only one or two at a time. Get back to first class and sound the alarm."
"I'll take care of Brogan," says Mr. Dorian,
and from his jacket, he pulls out his hide scraper and strides threateningly toward the other three, making vicious swipes through the air.
"Here they come,"
says Marin, as the first brakeman leaps the gap to the funeral car. All Will's body wants to do is retreat, but he forces it forward to meet the torrent of men. He has nothing to fight with, but suddenly remembers Mr. Dorian saying, "A good coat serves many purposes." Two brakemen rush toward him, their arms spread like predatory birds come to feast.
"Take hold of him,"
one shouts to the other. Will shrugs his coat off and slings it at the two brakemen. The wind plasters it against their faces. Their hands fly up to drag it off. Lurching, they throw each other off balance. One stumbles right off the roof. With a cry, he hits the gravel and rolls out of sight into the scrub. The second brakeman claws the coat off, but trips. He grabs hold of the roof's edge, legs swinging in empty air. Will can't bring himself to kick the man off. And then Will is seeing only little bits of things because everything is happening too fast. Behind him, Mr. Dorian is squaring off with Mackie, Brogan, and Chisholm. His terrifying hide scraper slashes the icy air. Even more terrifying is the expression on Mr. Dorian's face, teeth bared. His eyes blaze with menace. To Will's right, a brakeman grabs hold of Marin, but with an easy twist, she's free. He grips her again by both arms. With a shrug, she is loose. And this time, there are handcuffs dangling from one of his wrists. Cursing, the brakeman comes at her once more, and a second man crowds in on her from the other side and grabs her tightly. They've got her now, but Marin steps nimbly out from the tussle, and when the two brakemen lunge for her, they find they have been manacled together. They yank each other off balance and tumble to the roof in a heap. There are only two men in front of Will now, with a gap between them. If he can just cross five or six maintenance cars, he'll be above the crew cars. Get inside one of those, and he can spread the alarm. He runs for it. He dodges a brakeman and is about to jump to the next car when his legs are seized from behind. He crashes to the roof, all the breath knocked from him. Gasping, he turns over and kicks out at the fellow trying to shove him off. Will has never struck someone before, but it's instinctive. He surges forward and drives his fist into the man's face. The brakeman staggers back with a surprised grunt. Then his brawny arm pulls back and punches Will so hard he blacks out for a moment. When he comes to, his head is dangling over the edge of the car. The tracks blur past. The brakeman leans down to heave him off altogether, desperately. Will looks for something to grab hold of, but there's nothing. A long wooden pole catches the brakeman in the stomach and tosses him off the train, like a chopstick flicking a bit of beef. Will looks up and sees the Zhang twins striding past atop the train on their stilts. Lee nods down at Will.
"Hello, little bug," he shouts.
As Will scrambles back from the edge, he squints and sees another stiltwalker emerging from the sun's glare. It's Roal, a brace of throwing knives strapped across his chest. At his side lopes Mr. Beaupré. He no longer has to stoop as he moves across the train, but stands to his full 8-foot height. He jumps cars and is in the fray. Will is about to keep running to first class, but he sees Marin throwing herself back from a brakeman swinging a lug wrench. He isn't sure if she trips or the wrench strikes her in the shoulder, but she falls. Her head hits the roof hard. She doesn't move. He shouts her name and runs into the thick of the fight. Mr. Beaupré is already trying to wrestle the wrench from the brakeman's hands, as a second fellow pummels the giant from behind. Marin's body starts to slide off the roof. Will throws himself toward her, skids, and grabs her arm. Instantly, her hands are tight around him, and she's dragging him to the ledge. "Marin!" he shouts.
"Oh!"
she cries, blinking.
"I thought you were one of them!"
"You're okay?"
"I was just faking. I was going to flip him off the roof."
"We've got help!"
"I know."
"Tunnel!"
someone bellows, and Will whips around to see a mound of stone rushing toward them like a troll's head, mouth agape. Already the locomotive has steamed inside. The Jung twins drop to the roof, their long wooden limbs askew.
"Roal!"
screams Marin, and Will catches a glimpse of her startled brother as the mountain roars over him. There's a dull thud and a clattering sound, and then it's all darkness and noise and smoke for a few long seconds before light crashes over them again, and Will is coughing and blinking.
"Roal!"
Marin cries out again, and her brother springs up from his crouch, holding his one remaining stilt.
"I'm fine!"
he shouts, and launches the stilt along the rooftop.
"Heads up!"
Mr. Dorian steps deftly out of the way, and the stilt hits Mackie and knocks him off his feet. Brogan lunges at the ringmaster and then recoils, blood welling from a cut across his cheek. The two brakemen who've been manacled together charge the Jung twins and hurl themselves against their stilts, snapping one in half. The Siamese twins crash to the roof. Like a crippled spider, they try to rise. Suddenly, they're up on just two stilts, pirouetting like a ballerina. One of the manacled brakemen screams as Roel's knife buries itself in his shoulder. Will turns to see Roal with another knife at the ready, but before he can hurl it, a great gust of smoke and steam from the locomotive rolls over, making the world disappear. Wrapped in a pungent fog, Will feels dizzy. There is no up or down, and he drops to his knees and clutches at the roof. When the smoke clears, Will catches sight of Mr. Beaupré giving a howling brakeman's arm a twist. The giant then picks the man up, roars,
"I will throw you from the train!"
and does just that. Will looks forward. They're steaming straight for the stone flank of another mountain.
"It's the Connaught!"
one of the brakemen shouts. Will has heard of it. A tunnel that makes three complete spirals through the heart of the mountain. And here it comes, the gaping black hole lunging toward them. The darkness is total. Three blasts of the locomotive's whistle nearly blow his head off. He's aware of the ceiling overhead, roaring past. A faint glow from the train's side lanterns illuminates the shape of the tunnel. The roof is higher than he thinks, for the locomotive needs to pass through with its tall smokestack. As it begins its long, looping descent through the mountain, the train slows considerably, though not as much as it should with so many brakemen missing from their posts.
"I'm here!"
he hears Marin say beside him, and she takes his hand. Icy droplets patter down on him from the ceiling. Without his coat, he's starting to feel the deep cold. The roof is getting slippery. Locomotive smoke funnels densely through the tunnel, and ash stings his eyes. He can't see more than 2 feet in front of him. He wants to roll himself up like an armadillo and disappear. Shivering, he tenses, afraid of who might touch him. The smoke clears.
"Look out!"
cries Marin, gripping his shoulders and twisting him out of the way. A large shadow blurs past. In the fading light, he sees a tortured green and brown icicle of stone.
"Stalactite!"
he breathes, and ducks as another one rushes past. Around him, in the steam and darkness, he hears shouts and has no idea what's going on. He tries to figure out how many brakemen are left. 5? 6? The two manacled together, but one of them has a knife in his shoulder. The one with the big wrench. Then there's Brogan and Mackie and Chisholm. Another long gust of blinding smoke, and then a shadow looms over them. Mr. Beaupré bends down, smiling.
"I tossed another man from the train,"
he says happily. He sits down suddenly, and Will sees the dark, spreading stain on his chest.
"You're hurt," Will says in horror.
"One of them had a knife,"
he says matter-of-factly. And then his head lolls as if he's falling asleep. Will and Marin try to cushion his fall as he crumples against the roof. As the train continues its sharp turn, his body rolls. Will grabs at it, but it's too heavy, and Will has to let go or else be dragged off with it. With a sob, he watches Mr. Beaupré's body slide off into the tunnel and disappear. Another bank of smoke washes over them, and when it clears, this time Will sees Chisholm stooped before him with a knife.
"There you are,"
he says, coming at Will. He scrambles back with Marin. The knife quavers in Chisholm's hand. The brakeman is not altogether steady on his feet as the train turns and turns. Behind him, a pale aura begins to spread. They must be nearing the tunnel's end. Will sees the wickedly curved form of a stalactite spiking down from the side of the tunnel.
"Look out!"
he can't help shouting. Chisholm's smirk of disbelief is frozen on his face as the stalactite smacks him off the roof and against the tunnel's wall. The Boundless bursts from the tunnel, and Will is momentarily blinded by sunlight and mountain snow. Squinting, he rises to a wary crouch, looking quickly about. He sees the two manacled brakemen in retreat, limping back across the neighboring car, and a third jumps the gap, hurrying after them. There is no sign of either Brogan or Mackie. Have they already fled, or were they thrown off in the tunnel? Will lets out a big breath, and his shoulders drop a bit. The Jung twins hold the remnants of their broken stilts. Mr. Dorian looks about, his eyes wild, the hide scraper still clenched in his fist. Roald retrieves one of his knives from the roof and hurries over to his sister.
"Mr. Beaupré,"
Marin begins to say, then bursts into tears.
"I know," says her brother, hugging her.
She presses herself against his chest, and Will feels a sharp pang of longing.
"What happened?" Mr. Dorian asks, his face ashen.
"He was stabbed," Will tells him numbly. "We couldn't hold on to him. He slid off in the tunnel."
Heavily, Mr. Dorian sits down.
"Did you get what you came for?" Roald asks him.
For a moment, it seems the ringmaster hasn't heard the question, but then he nods.
"Yes. Yes, I did."
"I hope it was worth it," Marin says hoarsely. "You spent someone's life to get it."
"Shh,"
Roald tells her gently, but Will notices that the Jung twins are watching their ringmaster a bit warily. Mr. Dorian says nothing, and Will wonders what he's feeling, if anything at all. It starts to snow, huge, beautiful flakes flashing past, hitting Will's clothing and melting instantly.
"I need to get back to first class," he says. "We're done."
The idea seems impossible. The last 4 days have expanded into an entire lifetime. He has survived, but he doesn't feel exultation right now, only hollowed out with exhaustion and sadness. He takes a breath. He will enter the first class cars. He will tell Lieutenant Samuel Steele what happened in the junction, and everything afterward. At the next stop, he will see his father in the locomotive, and then...
"We are not done,"
says Mr. Dorian, looking at Will.
"Not quite yet. I need your skills, William."
Frowning, he asks,
"What for?"
"I need my portrait done."
"But what about Madame Le Moyne?"
"It has to be you, William. And it has to be now."
With effort, the ringmaster stands. Will swallows.
"Your heart?"
"Yes."
"I'm not sure I can,"
Will says desperately. He doesn't just mean he's worried about his skill as a painter. He's not sure he wants to help Mr. Dorian any longer.
"You listen to me," says Mr. Dorian, wincing with the effort. "I have spent precious years of my life and a considerable fortune working toward this moment. I have the canvas now, and you will paint my portrait."
"Why should I?"
Will shouts back, his own fury suddenly flowing out of him.
Why should you get to live when Mr. Beaupré died? When you risked all our lives? Marin might have died too. Do you even care?
Of course I do, he says warily. If he looked ill before, now he looks deathly.
What's this all about?
Roel asks in obvious confusion.
He's dying,
Marin says to Will. Will looks at Mr. Dorian, and his anger cools to pity.
Yes,
he says.
I'll paint your portrait.
Chapter 15. The Portrait of Dorian. Marin picks the lock of the maintenance car, and they all hurry inside, Mr. Dorian leaning heavily on Roel. Pungent with grease and paint fumes, the space is tight. Crowded shelves line both sides. Marin lights a lantern. Will is already rummaging around, knocking things to the floor in his exhausted haste. He grabs brushes, several cans of paint, a jug of what looks like turpentine. His studio. Roel settles Mr. Dorian gently on the floor, his back to some shelves, then goes to Meng and Li Zheng.
Keep watch from the rear of the car, he tells the twins. No surprise guests.
He gives Will a confused look.
I still think he needs a doctor.
No doctor, says Mr. Dorian through gritted teeth. What I need is right here.
He drags the canvas from his pocket and hands it to Will. I'll keep an eye out for Brogan and Mackie, Roel says, and heads to the front of the car.
We need to mount it on something,
Will says, kneeling and unfolding the canvas, painted side down.
No time,
says Mr. Dorian with a cough.
I won't be able to work it otherwise.
He looks around and finds a piece of plywood. He drops it to the floor and rummages in a few bins for some nails and a hammer.
Hold it tight for me,
he tells Marin, and proceeds to bang nails around the perimeter. He's almost afraid to touch the canvas, but it doesn't burn with cold or heat. His parents were never much for Bible learning, but he can't help wondering if there is something wicked about this fabric. He finishes hammering. The canvas is still slack in places, but it'll have to do. Mr. Dorian sits upright, as dignified as possible.
My left side is my best,
he says, managing a pained grin. Will looks at the scraggly brushes and paints. There is black and white, green and red, all the colors of the Boundless's exterior. He can make more from the primaries.
How good does this have to be?
He asks, starting to worry now. Another man's life is in his hands, and how does he know he's skilled enough to make this work? He's a good copier, but he's never done a proper oil portrait.
This is the chance you've been waiting for, William,
Mr. Dorian says.
The birth of the artist.
Marin places the lantern beside him, and he shivers in the faint warmth of the flame. The shadows chisel Mr. Dorian's features, so his head looks almost skull-like. Will knows there's no time to prime the canvas. He searches his jacket for his pencil stub. It's a small miracle it's still there. This pencil's a survivor. If he can pull off this painting, he will keep the pencil forever as good luck. Hunching over the canvas, he starts an outline of Mr. Dorian, sketching in the features, capturing the angle of the head and shoulders. The truth is, he can't paint. Not well, anyway. His drawings are sound, but his paintings are dead. This is how he thinks of them. Once he starts putting the paint on, the picture loses all its vitality. He slowly buries it, killing it with every brushstroke. He forces his eyes back to his subject, working hurriedly. Marin pries off the lids of the paint cans.
How do you like them arranged?
She asks.
Just here to my right, he tells her. I can use the lids to mix the colors. Can you find me some rags for the brushes?
The touch of his pencil to the canvas has sent no spectral sparks through his hands. He wonders if this is all nonsense, and Mr. Dorian has risked their lives for nothing. Mr. Beaupré is dead. Some of the brakemen are almost certainly dead. Will thinks of the man he sent over the edge. Is he dead, too?
Will?
Marin says quietly. He realizes he's just staring at the canvas.
Start,
Mr. Dorian wheezes.
He's terrified to start.
The drawing's a fair likeness. He fusses with it a bit more, but knows he's stalling. After dolloping some red onto a lid, he adds white, mixing until he has a passable pink. The light is so poor, it's hard to tell how flesh-like the color is. On another lid, he mixes red and green to make brown and then adds a bit to his pink to tone it down. He thins the paint with turpentine. This way, his lines can be finer and more careful. With the smallest brush, using his drawing as a guide, he begins painting in Mr. Dorian's flesh. Maybe he should have made the color whiter, for Mr. Dorian's skin is terribly pale now. The brush bristles are hard. They haven't been cleaned properly. His strokes are impossible to control. Panic mounts within him. How will he ever manage the mouth and eyes? He keeps staring up at Mr. Dorian, trying to force his eyes to follow and feel, but his eyes don't want to see right now. His head is filled with worry, crying out like a raven's ceaseless cawing.
"William, please hurry," says Mr. Dorian, and he flinches again.
Will knows he needs to get the paint down faster, but he's worried about getting lost as he obliterates his drawing bit by bit. With a rag, he cleans his brush and switches to dark brown to make a start on Mr. Dorian's hair. Then he changes brushes and works on the shadows around the ringmaster's nose and eye sockets. With careful strokes, he chisels deep hollows in the cheeks.
"Will," Marin says, "are you all right?"
He stares at his work, and it's happening again, just like it always does.
"The painting's dying," he murmurs.
"He's dying," Marin reminds him.
"Stop being so careful, William,"
Mr. Dorian says, wincing.
"Look at me, and paint me."
Will looks hard at the ringmaster. The shadows deepen, and his pale face seems to hang, suspended in space. There is nothing but the blazing head in the darkness. And suddenly, Will beholds Mr. Dorian for what he is, beyond his flesh and bones. It's like his whole life is pouring out of him, and Will sees all the desperation and fear and longing and a terrifying will to live, like a fire that will burn everything in its path. Feverishly, Will slops paint on a lid, mixing. He makes the colors he needs and does not thin them this time. He works wet on wet, putting more paint on the canvas, trying to keep it thick. The canvas seems hungry for more. The ringmaster is wheezing now.
"Hurry,"
says Marin. Something inside Will gets unlocked with these bigger, faster strokes. It's as if he can feel Mr. Dorian's face with the brush. He is mixing hastily, not bothering to clean between colors, just putting the paint down on the canvas.
"I'm done,"
says Will. Brogan stares down at the coupling behind the funeral car.
"You can't do it," says Mackie. "Not when we're in motion."
"It can be done," says Brogan.
And he shows Mackie the vial of nitro he's been carrying in his sand-filled pouch. Mackie's all he's got left. Chisholm disappeared in the tunnel, but Mackie had the sense to get himself hidden when the cavalry showed up with their stilts and throwing knives. They both retreated over the front of the funeral car.
"We've gone too far to stop now," he tells Mackie, sensing his doubts. "You're with me, or you're against me. Decide now, but know it's a bloody road we're about to take."
"I'm with you,"
Mackie says angrily.
"I'm getting Richard going to hell."
Brogan spent years blasting, drilling the coyote holes in the rock face, packing in the powder or the nitro, and running out the fuse. He's seen men blasted to pieces more times than he can count, but he never got so much as a scratch. He's like a cat. 9 lives.
"We blow this coupling and leave the rest of the boneless behind," he tells Mackie. "We've got the funeral car, and then we take the locomotive."
"How? There's the firemen and engineers."
"We tell them to hop it. They'll hop it."
He shows his gun. Mackie reminds him,
"There's no bullets."
"They don't know that. Would you risk it? And if they don't hop it, they get the knife."
Mackie says nothing.
"Then we drive the locomotive into the foothills, near Farewell. We blow the funeral car to bits, get the gold out. We're away down the river and across the border before the Mounties even saddle their horses."
He knows exactly what he's doing. He's bloodied, but not beaten.
"And look at it this way," he forces a grin at Mackie. "We got fewer people to share with."
Will gazes down at the portrait. It's good. What he's painted is good. Despite his clumsy mixing, the colors seem startlingly vibrant. It is not careful and realistic. No one would praise its photographic accuracy, but it captures the man himself. His soul, somehow.
Show me,
whispers Mr. Dorian. Will turns the painting round. It is a violent collision of colors and textures. Mr. Dorian's face is still as he beholds his portrait. He smiles and nods.
Yes,
he says.
That's it.
He exhales deeply.
Are you feeling better? Marin asks.
I am, he says.
He begins to stand, and without warning, his entire body jerks, and he cries out, clutching his left hand as though it has just been seared.
Mr. Dorian!
Shouts Marin. But he can't hear her, because he is moaning, the most urgent and heart-rending lament Will has ever heard. Mr. Dorian slumps over. Will helps Marin ease him to the floor.
What's wrong?
Roel cries, hurrying over.
It's not working,
Marin says, looking at Will in desperation.
Why isn't it working?
I'm going for the doctor,
Roel says.
No. No,
moans Mr. Dorian, but Roel is already barreling down the carriage.
There's nothing to be done.
Is there something wrong with the portrait?
Will asks, stricken.
Not the portrait,
Mr. Dorian says, wincing.
The canvas.
What?
Marin asks. Mr. Dorian shakes his head, his eyes rolling back. His lips are bluish. He mutters something Will can't understand, then grimaces and sighs.
The trickster. Tricked.
Several times his body twitches, and then is still.
Is he dead?
Marin asks. Will touches Mr. Dorian's cold wrist, tries to find a pulse. Can't.
His heart gave out,
Will says.
I don't understand,
she whispers.
The canvas,
Will says, understanding Mr. Dorian's last words.
There was nothing special about it. He was wrong. He got tricked.
The sound of a huge explosion reaches him at the same moment the carriage shudders, so violently that Will thinks the car has been knocked from the tracks. It tilts as the left wheels leave the steel, then it crashes back level. Will climbs the ladder and crests the roof. He sees the funeral car up ahead and can tell, just by the gap, that the boundless has been severed. The locomotive is slowly pulling its tender and the funeral car away from the rest of the cars. The back of Van Horn's carriage is disfigured from the blast, paint scoured off, the decorative plumes mangled. On the roof, Brogan and Mackie are moving forward in the direction of the locomotive.
How did they do it?
Marin gasps, hauling herself onto the roof beside Will.
Nitroglycerin,
he says. He's trying to judge the widening gap between the maintenance car they're on and the funeral car. If Brogan has explosives, who knows what he means to do? His father is on that locomotive. Urgent whistle blasts pierce the mountain air, the alarm to bring the train to a halt. Will can only hope that there are enough good brakemen left on the severed part of the train to slow it down, for it's headless now, and there are surely steep turns and trestles up ahead. Brogan and Mackie have jumped across to the bunk car where the firemen and engineers sleep when off shift, and beyond that rises the back of the massive tender, heavy with coal and water. To cross over top would be impossible, but along the right side runs a narrow catwalk to allow the crew to pass between the locomotive and their bunk car. Will starts to run forward, hunched over.
Will!
Marin shouts out behind him.
What are you doing?
I need to get across,
Will hollers back at her.
My father!
He reaches the front of the maintenance car. The gap to the funeral carriage is more than 15 feet now, and growing. He knows he can never make that jump.
Can you get me across?
He asks Marin, who has run after him. She looks ahead. Will sees a long stretch of straight track. Without a word, she takes her spool of wire and starts to swiftly unwind it across the gap. She hooks the grappling hook around a ladder rung at the back of the disfigured funeral car and latches her end to the rooftop. The boundless is connected once more, briefly, by tightrope.
We're at 15 feet now,
she tells him.
There's 30 feet in the spool. We don't have much time. You're going to have to walk with me. You'll need to trust me, Will. Can you do that?
Yes.
You can do this, right? I've carried an anvil. I can manage you. Go. I need to be behind you.
His will falters a moment.
Go, she says. Just walk and don't stop. Don't look down. I'll do the rest.
He takes his first step, and then another, and he's about to teeter off when he feels Marin's hands, one on his waist, another on his opposite shoulder, guiding him. Instantly, amazingly, he's steadied. He forces himself to keep going, looking only at his destination, the shuddering back of the funeral car. It takes concentration, but more than that, surrender.
Don't fight me,
she whispers. He wasn't aware he was. He tries to breathe.
You're doing well,
she whispers into his ear. Their destination looks just as far away as it did when they began, but he knows the gap between the cars must be growing, their tightrope line paying out foot by foot.
Well, I need you to go a little faster, she says in his ear. Just a little. Good.
In his peripheral vision, something tumbles past on his right and is gone. Moments later, another shape flashes by, and this time he realizes it's a person. He catches a glimpse of the overalls that the firemen wear.
He's forcing them off the train,
Will gasps.
Don't worry about that now.
A third person rolls past. Will doesn't know if they're dead or alive. Were any of them his father? He doesn't think so, but he feels Marin roughly push him.
Will, she says, pay attention.
Up ahead, he sees the track begin to curve.
We're going to bank to the right,
he gasps in alarm.
I've got you. Keep walking. Just look at the end of the wire.
The train starts to lean, and Will feels his body teeter. Marin's hands are firm, pressing, nudging. He looks down. He can't help himself. He's going to fall. He's going to be crushed between the cars.
You're okay, Will,
she says.
We're straight again. You're walking straight, and we're almost there.
He lifts his gaze to take in the back of the funeral car. They're getting closer, but it still seems that for every two steps he takes, the train moves ahead one. A shock travels through the wire. Suddenly it softens underfoot. He's aware of Marin looking back over her shoulder, but he dares not do the same.
Run!
She's shouting.
Just run!
And he doesn't need to look back, because he can see it in his mind's eye. The wire has gone as far as it can, and has snapped, and is sailing through the air behind them, falling swiftly. He runs, Marin's hands guiding him, her body so close that he feels like they're one person with four legs in perfect synchrony. The wire is as soft as snow beneath his feet, and they're running uphill now as the wire sags to the tracks.
Go! Go!
Marin shouts, and he puts on a burst of speed, accelerated by her body behind him. He reaches out for the mangled ladder at the back of the funeral car and seizes a rung. He swings to one side to make room for Marin. Glancing back, he sees the tightrope wire dragging behind him on the tracks, sending up sparks. The rest of the Boundless seems impossibly far away.
Not quite Niagara Falls, he pants. But close!
No one's ever done that before,
she says with some satisfaction. Mountains, their peaks bathed in the rising sun, tower around them, old as the planet. With Marin, he runs across the roof of the funeral car and jumps to the bunk car.
We should check inside, he says.
His father might have been off shift, but he doubts it. He would have wanted to be at the controls through the mountains, and if Will's right, Brogan and Mackie cleared out the bunk car and forced the men off the train. He hastily climbs down and sees the knobs smashed apart and the door ajar. He enters. Empty bunks, breakfast dishes shattered, and food scattered on the floor.
They definitely forced them off, Will says.
How many should be here?
Marin asks.
I don't know. They do shifts, that's all I know. Maybe two extra firemen and an engineer?
She nods grimly. The three people they saw tumble past the train. Will recognizes his father's jacket hanging on a peg, and the sight of it makes his throat ache. They parted on such cold terms.
Big fellows, these firemen, aren't they?
Marin asks.
Brogan doesn't even have a gun.
He has a gun, but no bullets. But they don't know that. And he's good with a knife.
Do they have weapons up there?
Marin asks. Will shakes his head.
Don't know.
Back outside, the tender rises before them like a cliff. Along the catwalk at its side, there's no sign of Brogan and Mackie. They've already reached the locomotive. Single file, he and Marin edge along the narrow walkway. It starts to snow again. As they near the locomotive, the flakes are wheeling down in thick sheets, matting the metal surfaces. Will hangs back and leans out to peer into the locomotive's lower level. Normally, a fireman would be stationed here, ready to shovel coal from the chute into the firebox, but the compartment is empty now. He swings himself inside the open doorway, Marin close behind, and looks around. A shovel lies askew on the floor, a spill of coal beside it. He listens, but can hear nothing above the titanic chugging of the pistons. Fire blazes from the open furnace. Steam hisses through the many escape valves around the boiler. Here, at the very front of the Boundless, there's an incredible sense of propulsion. The landscape flies past on all sides, and for the first time, Will can look straight ahead to the tracks that are being devoured by the locomotive as it hurtles into the mountains. Outside the compartment, metal stairs continue up to the second fireman platform, and then upward again to the engineer's cab. Quietly, Will heads up, snow driving at him hard. He keeps his body close to the side, and when he's halfway up, he peeks into the second-level compartment. It, too, is empty. But overhead, he hears footsteps from the engineer's cab and shouting, though he can't make out the words.
"They've got all of them up there," he whispers to Marin.
"Someone's coming down,"
she hisses, and they both dart up inside the fireman's compartment and press themselves to the wall. Through a small window, Will catches a glimpse of two firemen, their hands raised wretchedly above their heads, descending the outside stairs. They don't carry on to the lower level, but head out along a narrow footboard that slants down against the boiler to the very front of the locomotive. Snow flies hard. Following the two firemen comes Will's father, his hands also raised. Behind him is Brogan, his pistol held out. He marches them into the driving snow. Will peeks his head out the open doorway to watch them make for the pilot, a small platform atop the cowcatcher at the locomotive's very front. Will pulls back inside, looks frantically around the compartment for some kind of weapon. He seizes a shovel.
"Is this a plan?"
Marin asks worriedly. Before his courage fails, he steps out onto the footboard and stealthily follows Brogan, hoping the brakeman won't turn around. Scalding heat pours from the boiler's massive flank, and the noise of pistons and venting valves is almost blinding. Whirling snow turns the world black and white. Will tightens his grip on the shovel. Another 20 feet, and he'll be close enough.
"Hop it!"
Brogan bellows at his prisoners when they've reached the pilot.
"You're low enough, you'll likely survive with a few busted ribs."
"There's no bullets in the gun!"
Will shouts.
"William!"
his father calls out, and there's a question in his voice. For the first time in a long time, Will remembers his painted face and dyed hair.
"Pa, it's me!"
Brogan looks back at Will, but the gun's still aimed at his father.
"You sure about that, boy?" he says. "You want me to test my aim on your father, do ya?"
"Mr. Dorian took all the bullets out!"
Will hollers. Brogan smirks.
"A man always has extra ammo."
"He's lying!"
Will shouts, but is thinking, what if he's telling the truth?
"Will, get back!"
his father yells. Brogan charges up the footboard toward Will, who swings his shovel at the brakeman. He hits Brogan hard on the shoulder and knocks the gun from his hand. It clatters down the metal catwalk. But before Will can swing the shovel again, Brogan wrenches it from his grasp and slams it into his chest. The cracking pain swells to fill Will's entire body.
"Brogan!"
he hears his father bellow. Will feels the prick of a knife point against his throat, and Brogan wheels him around in a headlock. His father, pistol in his hand, stops short.
"Let him go!"
James Everett yells.
"Shoot!"
Brogan pants.
"It ain't got no bullets!"
Will's father takes aim at Brogan's head and squeezes the trigger. Nothing.
"Now," says Brogan, "I've killed already. I got no compunction about doing it again. You want your boy alive? You and your men hop it, and I'll let him hop it after you."
Will feels the blade press harder against his skin. He stays very still.
"Go on!"
Brogan bellows.
"Or I slit his throat! All of you, go!"
There is a lull in the driving snow, and the sky opens enough to let the sun through. Will sees the mountains rising up to the right. The air trembles. A rumbling builds above the roar of the steam engine. On the distant slopes, the snow puckers and begins to slide.
"Avalanche!"
he gurgles against the choking hold around his throat.
"Avalanche!"
His father turns his gaze to the mountain.
"Brogan, let me back to the cab!"
Will can't see Brogan's face, but he feels the twitching tension in his body.
"Stay right there, Everett. Mackie's in the cab. He's doing fine." "You need to stop the train!"
Will's father waves his arm at Mackie up in the cab.
"Stop!"
To Will, it doesn't feel like they're slowing much. The locomotive rounds a bend, and up ahead, 500 yards, snow spills across the tracks and then down into a deep river gorge, spray rising as from a waterfall. Now Will hears the shriek of the brakes, and the train slows faster, but not fast enough. They're in the snow now, deeper and deeper, the cowcatcher sending torrents of ice back at them. Dead ahead, Will can see a looming wall of snow. And then he's in the air, half stunned by the concussion that stopped the train in its tracks and yanked him off his feet. He has spun free of Brogan, everything white. He curls to protect himself, for he doesn't know how or where he'll land, but he hopes it's soft. No one sees this. At the back of the Zirkus Dante cars, Goliath paces his cage. The Boundless has finally been brought to a standstill in the driving snow. The Sasquatch's nostrils flare again and again as he breathes in a scent that is acutely familiar. It provokes in him a frenzy of restlessness. He wails up at the narrow vents. He thumps his fists against the reinforced walls. He crouches, crushing handfuls of straw in his fists. Then he stands tall, ears straining at the faraway cry. Goliath bellows again, and when he hears a return call, it's closer. He whirls about in his cage, thrashing against the bars, throwing himself so hard against the wall that the wood creaks. Something thuds atop the roof of his car, and he stops and looks overhead. A second thump, then a third. Dark shapes move past outside the vents. Powerful hands thrust inside and begin to rip the wall apart. Goliath sets up a wail of jubilation as plank by jagged plank his view opens up. Sky, mountains, and the high forests whose smell he recognized as home. Snow is packed up Will's nostrils. He thrashes about, not knowing how long he was unconscious or which way is up. He fights his way toward the light. His head breaks the surface. Gasping, he realizes that the snow isn't moving. The avalanche is over, but just. A low layer of mist still hangs over the ground. The stillness is remarkable. It feels like a force squeezing against him. Gone is the clackety motion of the train that had come to feel natural to him over the past days. Wind shushes against his eardrums, and he hears a trill of birdsong and the distant rumble of water. He looks about for his father, for Marin, Brogan. They too must have been thrown off the locomotive when it collided with the wall of snow.
"Help! William!"
"Pa!"
Will paddles his way atop the snow, in the direction of the call, in the direction of the gorge. He remembers the snow spilling over the edge like a waterfall. Carefully, he slides down the slope and spots his father clinging to a shrub at the edge of the precipice.
"I'm coming," Will says. "Hold tight."
He swims as close as he dares.
"Grab hold of me."
"You'll need to hold something first," his father says, "or you'll get dragged over."
Will looks around. There's a tree behind him, but it's too far for him to reach.
"We'll just have to manage it," he says.
From the slopes comes a sound that Will first heard 3 years ago in these same mountains. An animal call unlike any other. It begins as a low, mournful hoot and builds in intensity and pitch to a terrifying shriek. The voice is joined by another and another until it's a ghostly chorus wafting through the snow-curtained pines.
"Will, wait!"
Marin swims toward him, caked in snow. She grabs hold of the tree and stretches out to Will. They lock hands. Now Will can reach his father.
"Good,"
his father grunts as he takes hold. Will pulls. Marin holds him tightly. James Everett scrambles and kicks, trying to get himself up over the edge. With a lurch, he makes it, and they all scramble into the safety of the tree's branches.
"You're all right?"
Will asks his father. There's some blood matted around his ears, but he seems otherwise unharmed.
"I'm fine. You too?"
"Yes."
James Everett wipes snow off his shoulders and chest. Some papers rustle in the large pocket of his overalls, and he pulls them out and carefully brushes off the melting snow. Will catches a glimpse of the hand-sewn sketchbook he gave his father 3 years ago.
"Don't want it getting wet," his father says.
Will can't help smiling. Another chorus of animal sounds wafts over them. Near the buried rail bed, Will sees the solitary figure of Brogan slogging through the snow in the direction of the locomotive. In the mist, silhouettes appear. At first, Will thinks they're people come from the Boundless to help, but he soon realizes they are too tall to be human, their shoulders too broad. They stand eerily still. Then the closest suddenly moves, hurtling himself forward to land on all fours, then pushing off with its legs. It lands 10 feet in front of Brogan and stands tall. Will squints.
"Is that Goliath?"
breathes Marin.
"He must have escaped."
Brogan takes a few steps back, knife in hand. Goliath steps forward. Then Brogan turns clumsily and starts thrashing through the snow. Goliath overtakes him easily, pushes him deep into the snow. Will can see Brogan struggling, his hands and feet kicking up, but the Sasquatch leans down, and there's a scream, and then silence. Will feels his insides flash hot and then cold. He thinks he might be sick. Goliath looks up from Brogan's body at them. "Don't move," Will's father says. The other Sasquatch are silent. Will can hear Goliath punch air through his nostrils. He's sure the Sasquatch is looking right at him. A gunshot cracks the air, and then another. A man in a scarlet uniform, on snowshoes, comes into sight from the direction of the train. The Sasquatch disperse as quickly as dry leaves in a sudden breeze, all except Goliath. He reaches down to Brogan's body and, with a swift movement, rips his head off and spikes it on the branch of a tree. He gives a final bellow before disappearing into the forest. And then Lieutenant Samuel Steele and two firemen are calling out to Will and his father and Marin and unfurling ropes to help them out of the deep snow. Chapter 16. Clearing the Tracks.
"You can't arrest her!"
Will protests as Lieutenant Sam Steele manacles Marin.
"By her own admission, she helped rob the Boundless," says the Mountie.
"But Mr. Dorian was forcing her," Will insists.
"He wasn't forcing me,"
Marin says quietly.
"He was, in a way,"
Will counters, irritated that she's not helping him with his lie. They are all in the locomotive's bunk car, shivering themselves warm around the stove. Will's father shovels in more coal and sets a kettle atop to boil. Their boots make puddles on the floor. Marin sits looking at her manacles with amused curiosity. The two firemen have laid Mackie's body out and covered it with a blanket. His neck must have been broken inside the cab by the same impact that sent everyone else flying clear. Amazingly, the locomotive wasn't derailed when it plowed into the wall of snow. The tender, the bunk car, and the funeral car all stand on the track, unharmed.
"In addition," the Mountie says, "she endangered the lives of others aboard by not telling us sooner about Brogan's plot."
"But I didn't tell either,"
Will exclaims.
"I'm aware of that," says the Mountie. "Three times I saw you in the carriages and you said nothing to me."
Recklessly, Will says,
"Well, you should arrest me too."
"Will!"
Marin and his father say at the same time.
"I am considering it, young sir," says Steele.
This makes Will pause a second, but he pushes on.
"She saved my life in the Muskeg. Without her, I couldn't have warned my father, or stopped him going over the edge just now."
"Remarkable heroism, no question," says Samuel Steele. "And it will certainly weigh in her favor when she's brought before the magistrate in Lionsgate City."
"Is this truly necessary, Lieutenant?" Will's father asks.
"I'm afraid so, Mr. Everett. The law must be upheld. When we get things a bit more settled, I'll transfer her to the jail in second class."
"May I have a blanket?"
Marin asks, shivering. Will takes a large blanket off one of the bunks and drapes it over her shoulders.
"Thanks,"
she says.
I'm sorry, Will says awkwardly. I didn't see it ending like this.
Neither did I.
She smiles.
Well, at least you've got a good story to tell. And I think this one definitely happened to you.
He nods.
I guess so.
He wishes he hadn't used the word ending. Is that what this is? The kettle starts shrieking atop the stove.
Can I offer you a mug of tea, Miss Amberson?
Will's father asks, moving to the boiling kettle.
It'll help warm you up.
When Will looks over at Marin, she has pulled the blanket right over her head and wrapped it around her like a teepee. She must be really cold.
Marin,
says Will's father, offering her the cup of tea. She makes no reply, nor does she move. Will holds his breath, watching. The Mountie steps over.
What are you playing at, girl?
He takes the blanket and yanks it off, revealing a pair of manacles on the empty bunk.
This is unacceptable, mutters Lieutenant Steele.
While the Mountie and James Everett hurriedly check the inside of the bunk car, Will charges to the doorway and climbs onto the roof to get a better view. There's no sign of her in the snow-strewn landscape. He wants to cheer and call her back all at the same time.
I gather that's called the disappearing act, says James Everett, climbing onto the roof with Sam Steele.
Will thinks there is a trace of a smile on his father's lips.
She's foolhardy if she thinks she can run for it, Steele remarks. With the Sasquatch on the move?
Will looks about, feeling suddenly desolate. She wouldn't really strike out alone into the wilderness, would she? No one could survive out here. She must have a plan. The emptiness inside him contracts into a hard ache. Is this it? Is this how she always imagined it? That after the robbery she would say goodbye and never see him again?
There's no time to worry about her now, says the Mountie. I need a rescue party for the men who were forced off the locomotive. They're likely injured. And I need deputies to apprehend those last three brakemen.
He looks at Will.
Two of them manacled together, or with wrist bruises, yes? Shouldn't be too hard to find.
Will follows his father's gaze to the funeral car, the door in its side still open. Let's get that door closed, his father says, and then we need to start digging ourselves out.
I'll assemble a team for you, says Steele.
Will points.
I think it's already assembled.
Slogging their way along the tracks is a steady stream of crew and passengers, men in fine overcoats, colonists in their bulky woolen layers, and amongst them, two stilt walkers and an assortment of oddly dressed people who could only belong to the circus.
All we need are shovels,
one of them calls up. Will digs in and tosses more snow to the side. All along the buried track, people are working to clear the rails with shovels, buckets, soup ladles, anything they could lay hands on. Their muffled voices and laughter carry through the clear mountain air. Kitchen staff bring sandwiches and hot drinks, and the mood is almost festive. He has a memory of winter mornings in Halifax, when all the neighbors would be out shoveling after the night's snowfall. He looks over at his father, working alongside him.
Can you put the train back together?
We'll need to repair the couplings they blasted apart, but we've got a welder aboard. Shouldn't be a problem. I want to get clear of here by nightfall.
Will glances up at the fireman atop the locomotive, a rifle in his hands, scanning the slopes for Sasquatch. So far there's been no sign of them. Will hopes Marin is safe. Wherever she is. Most likely she struck out with her brothers. He hopes at least Christian is with her. Will likes the idea of her having an animal handler along, especially one used to dealing with Sasquatch. And what about the reward Mr. Dorian promised her? The $5,000 to start her own show? It seems too unfair if she doesn't even get that. The ache in his throat gives another contraction.
Do you think Sam Steele will try to catch her?
He asks his father.
Not right now, certainly. And maybe not ever. I'll have another word with him, see if he'll drop the charges. I've no wish to pursue them. She seems like quite a remarkable young woman.
From the corner of his eye, Will sees his father watching him and keeps digging. His cheeks feel hot. He's not worried about Marin getting caught. Not if she doesn't want to be. No locks can hold her.
No chains bind her. She'll always have her freedom. But maybe if the charges were dropped, she'd come back. His father claps him on the shoulder. You did well. I don't know many lads